Hello and welcome to House of Commons podcast, the longest running political podcast in the UK, I'm reliably informed. And personally, I think the best, of course, but then again, I might be biased. this week, we're doing our regular monthly co-host special, where the three of us, Emma Burnell, who's a Labour activist and blogger. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Nick.
And Mark Thompson, who's an ex-Lib Dem activist, but still a political blogger. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Nick.
How long do we have to call you an ex-Lib Dem for, Mark?
I don't know. I'm starting to think the statute of limitations is running out on it now. Maybe I'm now just my own man.
Yes, indeed. An individual political blogger, maybe.
Yeah.
So we'll discuss a few of the topics that have been in the news the last couple of weeks. Where shall we start? Well, unfortunately, I think where we'll have to start is UKIP, who seem to be very good at... getting prominence in the political news at the moment. Obviously, last week was really bookended by them because it started off with the posters, which, I mean, I wrote a blog about on for the Bright Blue website about how I thought it was basically un-English and how they were turning from being the sort of fun joker in the pub into a, essentially a lout who somebody needed to have a word with. And then at the end of the week, we found out that they had a candidate in Enfield who wanted Lenny Henry to go and live in a country where black people were from. I don't know why he picked on Lenny Henry, whether he had a bad experience in Travelodge or...
I think it's because Lenny Henry's been calling for more diverse representation in the media.
All right, okay, that's the reason why. Okay. So
it wasn't because he was jealous of the fact that it was Lenny Henry rather than David Copperfield, whose career went on to great things after Three of a Kind.
Well, that's Tracy Ullman.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he's jealous of her as well, yeah.
Yes, well, you know, there might be multiple motives. Or maybe he is a very, very, very subtle, dry sense of humour type of guy, and he knows that Lenny Henry was born in Dudley, which is part of the black country.
Yeah, I really don't think it's that nuanced, to be honest.
Okay, well, yes, I don't think we should give him that much credit. But, Emma, are UKIP a racist party?
UKIP are a party that contain a number of racist people. And when UKIP have this much prominence of racists, you know, this many people standing for the council that they failed to vet, then you can't help but wonder what has made that happen. You know, Nigel Farage has been open about saying that he's been very keen to recruit former BNP activists. He's made that a big part of his electoral coalition. Now, you know, the BNP have fallen apart, but the people who supported them for racial reasons, you need somewhere else to go. They've been given somewhere that is outwardly more respectable to go. Is UKIP a racist party? No. Do they stoke racism for electoral terms? Yes, absolutely they do. Does it help to call them racist is the other big question. Do we make a distinction between the racist politicians that they definitely have, like Mr. Enfield? Not Harry, obviously. Maybe he's jealous of Lenny Henry, who knows? And their voters who maybe have concerns that might not be racist, but might be considered, you know, close to the bone on in terms of immigration. And how do you change that dialogue? How do you change that narrative rather than simply, you're racist, you're establishment, we don't care what each one thinks, let's just have a big old Barney. How do you actually move this on?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I mean, Mark, what's your take on all of this?
I think I largely agree with what Emma said there. I think what we've started to see in the last week, though, is I think UKIP has seemed to be for quite a long time to, I think, quite a lot of people, this kind of fun, you know, new up-and-coming insurgent party with Nigel Farage, who's a bit of a geezer, you know. You can imagine going down the pub and having a pint and a fag with him.
Can I just interject here and say that I cannot imagine anything worse than going down the pub with Nigel Farage?
Well, I don't drink or smoke, so, you know, I don't...
Can I interject here and say I think he looks like he has bad breath? I might be completely wrong, of course.
About this too much, Nick.
Yes, my dreams are sometimes very disturbing. Anyway, Mark, sorry, we cut you off there.
I mean, so, I think that has been the narrative of the last few years, really, to be honest. And I think in the last week we've started to see a bit of a change in that instead of the media absolutely lauding Farage and letting him get away with stuff that other people would never get away with, they're actually starting to call him and the party to account more. So we saw Nick Robinson, BBC political editor, buttonhole him and grill him about his wife. And about, you know, the fact that he employs his wife and she's German, and isn't that giving someone from another country a job, you know, that could have been taken by someone from Britain? And I thought Farage did a pretty weak job of trying to defend that, because it was exactly the sort of defence that had someone from another party been trying to say that, UKIP would have been on them. They would have been straight after them, and they would have been saying same old, political class, you know, closing ranks and all of that stuff. It really, really smacked of hypocrisy. And then, of course, we've seen these, you know, these instances of candidates and activists saying and doing and tweeting things that, frankly, are the sort of thing you'd expect to have come straight from the BNP. So, and, you know, it's not just one incident. You know, I was looking back. Actually, when you start Googling this, you see that actually there have been these instances that have happened over the years. But usually the little one-offs, and they maybe get reported a bit, and then often they're just reported in like local media, and then they kind of fade away. But there seems to be a concerted effort by the media now. Maybe it's tall poppy syndrome. You know, Farage has been built up over the last few years, and now, just as we're getting to the zenith of his powers, where he seems to be at the point where UKIP could well top the poll in a few weeks' time, that the media is starting to turn and starting to have a pop. And actually, let's face it, there's a lot to have a pop about, and I think that's what we're seeing.
I mean, I'm thinking of starting up a Tumblr site called UKIP Aren't Racist But, and just basically listing all their racist people have been attracted to them. And I don't think they are a racist party, but I do think they are a xenophobic party, and I do think actually they're becoming nastier. And what I find very interesting is as they become more professional, which they have by getting Patrick O'Flynn from the Express in to run their operations, their edge has become harder. And we saw this very much in the posters of last week, where it was a very, very hard negative message, which essentially people could read, or, you know, read negative things into that.
So unlike the Express.
Well, I mean, he didn't mention that EU nationals would cause an increase in cancer, so or the decreased house prices. I suppose that's where it was different from the Express. but so, you know, in the past,
no Diana.
No mention of Maddie. Maddie was taken by an EU citizen. I don't know why. Maybe that's the next campaign.
Well, you know, the one of the main reasons they want to get out is obviously because the French killed Diana. So.
Yes, of course. Yeah, well, no, of course, that's as good as any of their other reasons. but in the past, they were almost a bit like, you know, your granddad or your, you know, your slightly uncouth uncle, in a way, where they would say things that are a bit unacceptable. And some of it was a bit true. But also, you just sort of go, well, oh, never mind. They're, you know, they're from a different age, maybe. They're just trying to get with the world, and I can sort of see where they're coming from. And the bumbling side was a little bit charming. But now, as they've become more professional, shall we say, they've lost that, and now they just seem to be nasty. And I wonder, and I really think this week, because of those posters, it's actually because it's taken away the bumbling side. I think that's why the press have gone at them, because they've actually seen a professional operation, political operation, and so they know how to attack and go at a professional political operation. Well, so I wonder if actually the posters will maybe help solidify some of their vote, but will actually stop people who may want to flirt with them and do a protest vote thinking, well, actually I would like to protest vote, but that's a bit too far.
But it's interesting, isn't it, because Farage constantly tries to play this, you know, kind of Westminster outsider card. of, you know, where he's, his party, you know, he's not part of the political class and he isn't part of the political class. It's absolute bollocks. He is a politician to his fingertips, and he is as ensconced in the political class as any of them. You know, he's been in the European Parliament since, you know, since 1999. That's 15 years. He's been in there way longer than Clegg ever was, for example. You know, the idea that they're outsiders is just, it's just preposterous, frankly. And I think what you're saying there, Nick, I think that's quite an astute observation you've made there, because yeah, those posters, okay, they were nasty, but you're right, they were very professionally produced and they were launched and they've had a lot of coverage. That's the sort of thing you'd expect from a mainstream party, and so actually the media are now treating them as a mainstream party, and Farage does not like it, and it looks to me like he can't handle it either.
I think also what's been happening is that as their support has been getting higher, closer to the election, some of their nastier elements have become very emboldened and freer, perhaps, to behave nastier in a way that other parties' activists wouldn't do. You know, other parties' activists will go after each other during an election campaign, but they won't start suddenly feeling more emboldened to attack their... Well, maybe they do. I mean, maybe that's why you get so much welfare crap during... during election campaigns. But you know what I mean? If your issues are quite extreme and you have very extreme views within your party and those people feel emboldened and like it's their time, then that's what's happening, I think. That's, you know, they're feeling like their time in the spotlight is now coming and that they can say these things because UKIP are about to give everyone a good hiding.
Yeah, and also the posters, I mean, to sort of... almost to repeat that the horrible 2005 Conservative campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, are you thinking what we're thinking? Oh yes, UKIP are actually thinking what we're thinking. So now I can say it.
Yeah.
Bang, Lenny Henry should go back to somewhere or other, which isn't Wolverhampton. And
Dudley.
Dudley, yeah. Or, you know, somewhere hotter. I think the Enfield guy wanted. So maybe these the elements within their party who essentially, you know, were, shall we say, more BNP, EDL links, have suddenly thought, well, actually, no, we can say these things because we've seen these posters and everything. I mean, I have a very interesting, you know, view on all this because I'm standing in the local elections in Hillingdon, in one of the wards in Hillingdon, the Conservatives. And the UKIP here is led by a guy who basically was an ex-English Democrat and, you know, very proudly has been on EDL rallies and has them on his website. And essentially, when he switched over to UKIP, he wrote a blog saying why he did that, and the reasons why he gave was essentially that UKIP have a better chance of winning. So he hadn't changed his views, but he just thought UKIP were, you know, still within his frame of thinking, but had a better chance of winning. And, you know, he basically, I mean, the other day he because in the north, in one of the wards in Uxbridge North, in the north of the borough, our leaflets are sponsored by a local tandoori place who, obviously, the deal is they get their sign on our leaflets and then they'll do all the delivery for us. And this guy, he sent out, Cliff Dixon is his name, he sent out a tweet saying, Tory leaflets are sponsored by the local tandoori, what would your gran say? You know, and that's sort of, well, actually, you know, my grandma...
Well, Tory grand.
Well, no, indeed.
Enterprising.
Indeed. And also, it's, you know, I mean, how long has... I don't know how old is he. His grand's obviously a lot older than my grand. But, you know, curries and tandooris have been a part of our culture and our life for a long, long time. But it's just that sort of, you know, attitude, which I don't think would be acceptable. I think if a Conservative candidate, for instance, sent out that tweet, I think that would be completely unacceptable, and they would be in trouble for it, for instance. But there seems to be, you know, he's attracted to UKIP, and UKIP are okay with him leading UKIP Hillingdon, and essentially, you know, promoting a very strong anti-immigration message, which then slips over really into xenophobia.
But as far as I can see as well, I mean, I had a number of discussions with people on Twitter about this today, because I started to get a little bit kind of exercised about it because, you know, some of the disgusting things that I've seen. You know, and I was quite interested to see what the reaction of kind of UKIP activists was. And as far as I can see, I mean, maybe, you know, it's only a small sample. It was five or six that I was kind of discussing it with during the day today. But they seem to be completely in denial about this.
Yeah.
The defence seems to be, well, all parties have racists.
Yeah.
Well, yes,
yeah,
that's true. All parties do have people that are racists. And, you know,
Did the Lib Dems
yeah,
have
yes,
this?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I've known a couple of people within the Lib Dems that I would definitely label as racist. Oh, yeah, it takes all kinds. But what I would say is that in the other mainstream parties, there are far fewer racists than there are in UKIP, and that's what they're in denial about. Yes, they can try and use this fig leaf of, well, you know, all parties have, you know, people on the extremes and nutters and all the rest of it, and of course that's true. But what they have to do is look at themselves and think, why are there so many in our party, and why do they feel emboldened to be as vocal as they have been? You know, that's the key, and it's because, let's face it, the UKIP agenda, I wouldn't describe it as racist either, like Emma wouldn't. What I would say is it's flirting at the edges of what is acceptable.
Absolutely.
And it's pushing those boundaries.
And it's pushing our dialogue towards that area. It's so that it's making it easier and more acceptable to push at those boundaries. And yeah, that makes me very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah, but it just seems like they just don't want to admit that that's what's going on. I think genuinely there are people within UKIP who are outraged and really, really frustrated that this is the way that the media narrative has gone this week. But, you know, frankly, I think it's going to get worse for them, because unless they do something, someone on Twitter today said, oh, yeah, well, we're weeding those people out. And I just said to them, well, good luck with that. I said, genuinely, I wish you luck with that. I think you're underestimating how difficult it's going to be.
Well, 100%, because in my experience, the leader of the local UKIP here is basically, he's basically changed from English Democrats to UKIP because he thinks they've got a better chance of winning, not because he softened his views. I love watching people fall on their own hypocrisy, really. And there were quite a few conservatives who left and joined UKIP, especially a couple of years ago. And the reason why they joined UKIP was because of, you know, strict party management and the fact that the Tory party weren't doing what they believed was going to happen, and UKIP was a freer type party, especially the libertarian element who joined them. And then, as you say, Mark, I've seen them all this week sort of saying, oh, this is what happens in political parties. You know, I just love watching them, thinking what you've done is you've jumped from one political party to another political party, which is actually turning out to be exactly the same, but actually worse in message, really, compared to what you believed. That's amused me. But I mean, what do we think? Do we think they're going to come top in the European elections?
I think they could well do. I'm not confident enough to put money on it, but I think it's probably the more probable outcome at the moment. The latest polls have them in the lead.
I kind of fear that Emma's right. I mean, you know, let's face it, it's not like this is the first time that these sort of stories have reared their heads. I mean, like I say, I think there's been a more coordinated effort by the media to actually really focus on it in the last week. But I fear that what might happen here is that Farage will do what he's very, very good at, which is kind of playing the poor me, the victim card, and claiming that it's, you know, it's all the media that are out to get him, and it's the political classes closing ranks against him. And, you know, we've only got another 2 or 3 weeks running to the Euro elections, and actually I think that the postal ballots have either gone out or are going out very soon. And I think there's going to be quite a high postal ballot in this election as well, so I actually think they could come top, and if they don't come top, I'm almost certain they'll come second.
I don't think that what's happened
in the last week will make that much difference to it. What I'm kind of hoping that is that it will give some people pause for thought, and it will at least stop this essentially free ride that Farage and UKIP have had for the last few years of being able to say whatever they want, do whatever they want, and still be lauded as this kind of fantastic insurgent, you know, breath of fresh air. I think we're starting to see they're not.
I think the right-wing press want UKIP to do reasonably well. Yeah. In these elections, and then we'll spend the next year destroying them so that they don't take too many Tory votes in the general. And that I think has been the kind of a sense of where the press has wanted to play the game.
So am I going to really start loving the Mail and the Telegraph and the Sun over the next year then? Don't you say?
I'm saying that you might start agreeing with them more over when they start attacking UKIP.
That's going to be cognitive dissonance city.
Okay, well, should we move on from, shall we say, one populist politician to another? Boris. He's been in the news again this week for his will he, won't he. And I think having read the stories, I think he definitely will, actually, because he's now coming up with a new promise. You know how politicians sometimes backdate their promises, which the old one was that he would never...
He made a solemn vow to the London Evening Standard that he would never, whilst being mayor, never would he take another political office of any kind.
And I'm starting to read that actually that promise is being, shall we say, evolved or shaped into that he will never be a cabinet minister at the same time as being an MP. So,
see, I was wondering if he was going to redefine what he meant by political office, and it sounds like that's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, no, indeed, that's exactly what he's doing. Having looked at the news, if you read political news very often, you can sort of see the drumbeats of what people are trying to shape, and this is definitely what he's trying to shape. And I think he is going to come back, and he's going to say, I wouldn't be a cabinet minister or a shadow cabinet minister while I'm mayor. I don't know what that tells you about what being an MP is like in terms of a full-time job. But
MPs I know work really, really hard, long hours. So what on earth Boris thinks he's going to do? MP, I mean, you know, there is precedent, obviously. Ken did stay in his seat until...
Yes, for a year.
So there is a precedent set there, but I think it was a bad precedent. I don't think you should have both jobs.
No, I agree.
I'm quite happy to say it was wrong when Ken Livingstone did it. I'm quite happy to say it would be wrong for Boris to do it too. Being mayor of a city of, you know, 8 million people is a big flipping job, and you should do it well. It's my city. Stop fucking around with it, dude.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I'm not sure he's doing the right thing, but anyway, we'll come back to that later in the discussion. But I was going to come to Mark on this. As a non-affiliated, politically interested person, do you think the return of Boris to national politics is a good thing?
I mean, I still struggle to really believe that he actually won the mayoralty. I mean, he's a joke candidate, really. And I know he's very, very intelligent, and he's a lot cleverer than he's given credit for. The persona that he kind of puts forward. We all know he's far cleverer than that. And there is a fair bit of kind of Machiavellian manoeuvring going on in the background. But I still don't really get it. I don't really get what the Boris phenomenon is all about. I mean, I honestly think if he ever did become Tory leader, I think firstly, he'd be a disaster. You know, once his honeymoon period was over, he'd have a few months. But, you know, once the serious grind work of getting on with the job of being, I mean, initially leader of the opposition, which, let's be honest, is the only way he's going to get it, because if Cameron wins the next election, then there's not a vacancy. And then I think Boris's chance is over, because another 5 years on from that, I just don't think he's going to be him. It'll be the next generation coming through. And I think that, I think he would not enjoy it either. I don't think he wants to do the really difficult, you know, long march work of being a leader of the opposition and eventually becoming prime minister. He's very lazy. I just don't, I don't get this whole thing. But I do think that he will find a seat, and he'll find some contrived way of making it seem like he's still sticking with his promise. Of course, if what happens in 2015 is that the Tories lose, there'll be a leadership election pretty quickly, and he'll have to throw his hat into the ring, and then he could well be leader of the opposition whilst still being mayor, and that isn't tenable, so he'd have to then resign as mayor, which he also promised he wouldn't do. So I still think he'll struggle to be able to not get away with that, but I suppose by that point that'll be ancient history and it won't matter too much. It'll be thrown back in his face occasionally. But yeah, I think the whole thing, you know, I still don't really get Boris Mania. I'm not sure I ever will, really.
My sort of taking it all is that, I mean, as you say, it's interesting to think back to when he, well, let's think back to why he became the Tory candidate for Mayor of London. The reason why he became Tory candidate for the Mayor of London was because his political career had completely crashed and burned. He as a shadow minister, he was an absolute disaster because he couldn't stick to his brief. He wanted to entertain, so he said things that inflamed people, and his political career was going nowhere. And at the time, there was an assumption within politics that London was a Labour city. So basically, being the candidate, the Tory candidate, would basically keep Boris active for like 6-7 months. But no one ever thought he would win it. I don't think even Boris thought he would win it when he first stood. If he came back into Parliament, and got a ministerial or even a shadow ministerial brief, you know, can he actually discipline himself? Can he do what's necessary to be successful at that lower level, shall we say, rather than being a leader of you know, in London he's a leader, so he can set the agenda, he can do what he wants, he can put people around him to help do the stuff that he's not interested in. Now I wonder if he can redo that and still keep his charm. I don't know. I don't know if this is part of his faults, because I don't have any privy to his faults, but I think one of the reasons, if the last London election, obviously he only just won it, but that was against a limping candidate in Ken Livingstone. I mean, the electorate never likes it when a candidate comes back and says, you were wrong, give me another go. And, you know, any other half-decent Labour candidate, I think, would have beaten him last time. And I think any of the Labour candidates that we're talking about this time will beat him next time. So in a way, I suppose he's got nowhere else to go, because why be a losing candidate than say, well, I'll give up and I'll go into Parliament? So I think he will do it. But I'm not sure whether how successful he'll be in the end. I mean, Emma, what's your take on Boris?
Well, I think there are a number of really interesting questions. First of all, what is most obvious is that when Boris decides to go for it, it's because he's decided Cameron's going to win the next election. Mark's completely right about the timing. He will only really get to be leader of the Conservative Party if the Tories lose next year. And when Boris makes this decision to run, it's because he's calculated that that is the most likely outcome. The other thing is this, you know, Boris is seen by some in the Tory party as their potential saviour, the man that can reach beyond their usual parts. Well, why doesn't he prove that? I was reading on Conservative Home that several of the Conservatives' key marginals, the ones that, you know, currently held by Labour and the Liberal Democrats, they haven't yet selected candidates for. Well, why doesn't Boris run in one of those rather than the safe Tory
seat? Hear, hear.
Why doesn't he put his money where his mouth is and actually prove that he can be this great, great, great white vote winner? I don't think he can. I don't think it's true. Why doesn't he run in Liverpool? That would be interesting.
I think no matter how charming he'll ever be, I think Liverpool will be slightly out of the question. And also, it's actually a very conservative thing to take the prudent option. So and he would walk any safe seat. You know, he basically has political charisma, and certainly within the Tory party, you know.
But if he wants to prove he can reach out to the parts that they are, you know, Conservative Party scraped and not win, but not losing last time around.
He doesn't have to prove that, because he doesn't have to prove that at the moment, because if he stands in a safe seat, let's say Malcolm Rifkin stands down in Kensington and Chelsea, and Boris then goes into Kensington and Chelsea, we lose the election, Cameron goes. Essentially, he has to appeal to the Tory voters, not to the country. And if he gets elected to leave, then he's got 4 years to work on that message. So, you know, I quite like the idea of him standing in a swing seat and to prove that he's got what it takes. But actually, if his
I don't think Boris has the confidence that he has what it takes to put his money where his mouth is.
Well, it's all about risk. He doesn't need to take that risk, I don't think. So he probably, you know, that's why he won't do it. I'd love it if he did it. It'd be great if he did, but he doesn't need to take that risk.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that, you know, political leaders or aspiring political leaders do tend to go for safe seats. They don't want to have a kind of rear guard action, you know, as and when the leader of the opposition or prime minister to even retain their own seat. I mean, you've only got to look at the kind of the safety of the seats of the current main party leaders. I think it is fair to say that, you know, that's the way it tends to go. I don't think Boris would be unusual in that respect, but I would like to see him try. And I think actually that could be the sort of thing that could help to sustain a very strong narrative for him if he was to do something like that. Of course, as you say, Nick, he won't, because he's not going to want to do that. But
Mark, he is actually lazy and he'd have to really work a seat.
Well, exactly, yeah. And I'm sure that's part of it as well. You know, Kensington and Chelsea would be an absolutely fantastic seat for him. Just down the road from Westminster, you know, absolute rock solid, guaranteed for life. Lots of nice swanky restaurants, you know. Be great. You know, he had Henley before. Kensington,
oh, God,
Chelsea,
he's going to make a bloody guest appearance in Made in Flipping Chelsea, isn't he? You can see it now.
You can get so
more reasons for me to continue not watching that programme.
You have to watch Made in Chelsea just once, Mark, for me, because if you play this particular game that I'm going to teach you whilst watching Made in Chelsea, it completely changes the whole show. Because the whole thing about Made in Chelsea is they're very bad at acting in their own life. So they spend their entire time doing these weird exchanges of glances, and it looks like they're playing an endless game of pretending not to be the one who farted.
I actually did catch about 6 minutes of it one time. I was in a hotel room and I was flicking around and I didn't know what it was. I kind of alighted on this thing and it was just like loads of people gossiping about other people in bed and over meals, and it kept going. And it was like really quite weird continuity between us.
Class war is what it is.
I couldn't quite get it. I was like, is this Hollyoaks? What is this? I couldn't quite get it. And then I thought, oh, it's one of these kind of structured reality in quotes programs. And then because of the poshness of everyone, I guessed it was made in Chelsea. And at that point, I turned it off.
Class war propaganda is basically normalising the lives of these insane people.
I think I'd prefer Desperate Scouse Wives, to be honest.
sounds perfect for Boris, actually. Yeah, maybe he probably will make an appearance on it.
But amazed it hasn't already happened.
Well, did he do EastEnders?
He did do EastEnders, yes.
And then obviously Margaret Thatcher went to the Rover's Return, didn't she?
As has Ed.
Yes, all right, there you go. but you don't think if Boris became leader, you wouldn't feel threatened by it as a Labour person, Emma?
No, I think if he becomes leader, the narrative is fairly obvious that he's expecting David Cameron to lose.
But let's say hypothetically, we lose the next election, but it's only a small majority for Labour. We get David Cameron leads and then Boris becomes leader. Do you think actually Boris is the person who can help push us over the hump to actually get a majority?
I don't think so. I don't think by 2020, no, I don't. I think he probably peaked at the Olympics, at or around the Olympics, and will be 8 years from then by this point, and he'll have, had to manage a squabbling party. And he's not the man to put in the hard work and do that, and to really, keep the party together with bare hands, sweat and string, which is what needs to happen once a party has gone out of power. I don't see him as the person who can do that. I think that while he is very charismatic, he's also very divisive within his own, party. So, and there will be powerful people he's pissed off, like George Osborne, for example. I think there will be enough people willing to and ready to stab him in the back, and he's stabbed enough people in the back that I can't see it being a massively successful leadership.
I mean, I think that really, I think the fact that the Tories are in government, they didn't manage to get all the way over the finishing line last time, so they've had to do it with a coalition. And I actually think that the Cameron modernisation task was only ever half completed, if that, actually. And that now that they're in government, it's kind of been a fig leaf over that because, Cameron's the Prime Minister, and the argument can always be made that, he hasn't been able to do, what his backbenchers would like him to do because of the Lib Dems. But actually, the Tory party needs to be in a position where if they were to get a small majority, they wouldn't be held to ransom by a bunch of, 20 or 25 pretty extreme right-wing backbenchers, which is where they are at the moment. That there's a lot of work that the Tory party needs to do to get to where it needs to be the sort of party that can win elections in their own right again. And Boris is not the man to do that. He just isn't. They need someone else. I actually think that what would happen if it wasn't Boris is it would be some kind of, someone probably even more right-wing. And I think they'd be in real trouble as well. So I'm not saying this is an easy thing, but Boris is not going to put the spade work in to do that. He would just flit around. He'd do all the celebrity stuff. He'd give good quote and he'd give good, press conference, I'm sure. And it would be a hoot for the press lobby, for the lobby pack. But it isn't what the Tory party needs for its long-term stability and its long-term rehabilitation.
That's a very interesting take. I mean, I think there's a whole sort of further segment programming what would happen to the Tory party if we lost the next election, who should become leader, which I'm sure we'll get onto in future episodes. But I do have to say, we haven't, what we've discounted in this conversation is actually that he has won London twice. And he does appeal to people who wouldn't normally vote Conservatives. And he is a star. He's a political star. I've been in rooms with him, big rooms with him, where with non-political people. And everyone's wanted to take a picture of him. Everyone's wanted to speak to him. And he has something that very, very, very few politicians have. And I don't think that should be discounted. Also, one thing that he has proven himself to be very adept at as Mayor of London is putting people around him who do a good job in what they do. So while he might not be the great person at detail, he does appoint people who can do a good job, for that. So, I often think being a very, very good leader, part of it is actually appointing the right people to the right roles. Maybe we're not giving him enough credit actually in that type of way.
That's a fair point, he is a political star, you're right, and he's one of the very few people in politics who, you'd say his first name and you know exactly who you're talking about. I mean, there is that. But no matter how many good people you've got around you, when you're Prime Minister or when you're leader of the opposition, there is nowhere to hide on certain occasions, like Prime Minister's questions, like responding to the budget statement. There are times when you have to have a full grasp of detail or you'll get found out. And that's where I think he will be found wanting.
Okay, all right. Well, I think it's probably time we move on to our next subject, which is a completely geeky political subject, which is the arrival of David Axelrod. Or as I misread it on Twitter, I thought Axl Rose was going to be advising Ed Miliband, which I thought would be absolutely inspirational. But anyways, no, it's David Axelrod. And for those who don't know who he is, he's basically, he was one of Obama's key men right from the beginning. And I'm not sure what he's going to be doing with Labour. I think I'll ask Emma to see if you can fill us in. So Emma, what actually is he going to be doing for Labour?
As I understand it, he's going to be advising on electoral strategy. So I don't know exactly what that means. I don't think he's going to be sat in Brewer's Green all day every day. Sorry, that's the Labour HQ. But I believe that he's going to be, working closely with the Labour's electoral team to finesse the strategy and bring some of the application that helped push Obama over the line for both first and second time to the kind of campaigning that Labour does over here. And I think that's quite interesting. It works quite well in tandem with a lot of the stuff that our other American advisor has been bringing to the party, which is Arnie Graf, who was nothing to do really with the Democrats party, but did teach Obama how to be a community organizer many years ago. So it's sort of a combination, I think, of making what Labour's biggest strength is. And I was reminded this when you were talking about your tandoori leaflets. We don't have our leaflets sponsored so someone else can deliver them, because we don't have the money, we have the manpower. And I think that's where they often say, don't they, they've got that's the biggest difference between the Labour and the Conservatives, is that we've got more activists and you've got more money, and it they kind of balance each other out in how you win elections. So I'm guessing that what Axelrod is really going to do is combine that, what we do with our activists, and really think about how we do that in a strategic way, in the way that Obama's campaign was both spot on in terms of how it devolved power to where people understood how to run their own election campaigns, but also how to make that understood at the centre so that everything was flowing properly upwards and downwards.
I mean, my take on it was that it was actually a very self-indulgent appointment, because he was a part of the campaign right from the beginning. But there has been so much research done and written on it, and that was a long time ago. I don't think you need him to be able to tell you to do that, Emma. I mean, I think he is. It's almost fanboys. You being able to bring somebody who they want to be close to over here, rather than bring somebody who can actually really help their election strategy. I mean, if they need him to tell them what is basically obvious, then that's a trouble for them, because I don't like this way that you sort of believe that if you can just parachute in an expert from the United States to help you run your campaign, it all will be brilliant. And I just think that's, you know, you're completely A, dismissing local talent, but B, that actually what you're buying is actually satisfying your own geekdom rather than doing the job in hand. I mean, that's...
Did you say the same thing about Jim Messina?
Oh, well, yes. as far as I'm aware, what he's done is he's actually given us the Obama email templates, and so we're using the same sort of type of colours, but I'm not sure what else he has done. But yeah, no, completely. And he's, I mean, Linton Crosby's different because he's done work here before, and, you know, in my
opinion... Oh, yeah, yes, of course he's local talent.
He learnt in his first election, which was the what I would describe as the terrible 2005 Conservative campaign, and he is in charge of that, but learned from his mistakes, came back and helped Boris win twice. So actually, you know, he has a good grounding in British politics. So I sort of let him off from that. But anyway, I mean, Mark, does this interest you in any way, or do you think it makes any difference, or are we just disappearing up our own geeky ballot papers?
Well, I mean, my understanding of what Axl Rod. You've got me now.
It'd be better if it was Axl Rose, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be, actually. Who's he going to turn his guns of destruction on next, hey? It's Appetite for Destruction.
Appetite for Destruction, but there you go.
I don't even know the names of the... I can't even do it. I think you said it's kind of fanboy thing. I think it's a bit more than that. I think it's that... Well, my understanding of what he's actually going to do is that it's largely going to be kind of, you know, video conference. He's not going to come and base himself over here. He's just going to kind of, you know, divine his wisdom from afar. And I think it's... Oh, and for quite a lot of money is my understanding as well. And I think it's probably going to give a fillip to the ground troops, isn't it? Because, you know, someone who was key in Obama's election is now helping the Labour leadership. And I'm sure that will give a bit of a boost to the ground troops, who will think, oh, you know, the leadership, they're doing something positive. They're trying to get a bit of Obama's sparkle and stardust. But, I mean, I think what this says, because it's not just Axl Rod, it is, as you said, Linton Crosby. It's also Ryan Coetzee for the Lib Dems. You know, all three major parties in this country now have kind of senior staff on the, you know, senior key people on the campaign staff who are not from the UK. Now, linking in with what we were saying about UKIP earlier on, that's not necessarily a terrible thing, but I think politics and the politics of different countries are very, very specific things. I mean, I follow US politics pretty closely, and I'm still baffled by quite a lot of what goes on there. You know, and whenever I try and kind of understand the politics of other countries, you know, when I've been abroad, I've been, you know, in English-speaking countries where I can kind of follow what the media is talking about, you know, in like Australia and New Zealand and Canada, and I don't really understand what's going on in those places either. I think it's very difficult to transpose political knowledge and experience from one place to another. I don't think it works like that. And also, it makes me think, what have we done wrong in this country that we haven't got people in each of the three major parties who can be trusted to be put in charge of election campaigns? Because it feels like, why do we feel like we have to go abroad for this? Why haven't we homegrown our own talent?
Indeed. I mean, I agree 100% with that. I mean, I did, I don't know, you're both on Twitter, and there's this great account called General Bowles, who just always makes up funny pictures of what's going on. And he did Miliband in the Obama style. Instead of hope, he put dope underneath it. So it'd be interesting to see how, you know, obviously Axl Rose knows so much, or Axl Rod, or whatever he's called. But you know, it's a very, very different situation, because with Obama, he went to Obama at an early stage and said, I believe you can do this right from the beginning. With Miliband, he sort of parachuted in and dealing with what he's got. But, I mean, Emma, I mean, are you worried about Labour's polling at the moment?
No, not really. I'd like us to be polling massively higher. Obviously, I'd like us to be polling at 60, 70%. 30% allows me to think of myself as a Democrat. So, but I think that we are in a completely different situation than anyone is used to. Labour's polling is hovering around the mid to late 30s, which is pretty good, actually, given where we started from. The difference generally is when the Tories go up and down. We tend to stick at around between 36 and 38. I'd like us to be over 40, but I think we're currently in a four-party situation where that's unlikely. So actually, our polling's pretty solid. The Tories are bouncing up and down a bit. I think we've got where we need to be to win the next election, if not comfortably, then to win it. I want us to be higher. I will work very hard to make that happen. But I'm not sitting here chewing my nails and thinking, oh my God, it's all over, all is doom and gloom.
I mean, I one of the things that I suppose this is a final observation, so we need to wrap up soon. But from most people I speak to, everyone I speak to across the major parties, all think they're going to do terribly and going to lose. So, I mean, that's one of the interesting things that's going to happen. The Tory mood has picked up a little bit, I have to say. But, you know, quite a few of my Labour friends are getting a bit worried about where things are going. But, of course, you know, we've still got a year to go, and don't we know it. And we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens in that year's time. But, okay, well, shall we call it a day then? Is that good? We've covered everything that's happened. So, okay, brilliant. Well, thank you to everyone for listening. And thank you to Audio Boo for hosting and Kevin McLeod for the music. And next week, I believe, is Emma, isn't it? You're co-hosting. Brilliant. So, yes, join us next week for Emma's show. Thank you very much. Bye.